Welcome. The next 45 minutes we're going to talk about working with Office 365 groups. So, just a quickie, how many of you actually have worked with groups? Few. So, I'm not going to spend too much time on introducing what a group actually is. Got a few slides on it, but not too much. And what we're going to talk about mainly is the development options. We're all developers here. So, what can you actually do from a development point of view with Office 365 groups? And there are actually three options. As an administrator or an IT admin, you can use PowerShell, and you can do pretty interesting stuff with PowerShell. Then we're going to have a look at extensibility of groups itself, so working with connectors, and then we're going to look at Microsoft Graph, which is the endpoint that you can use to actually query or retrieve data with Office 365 and thus using it in groups. Now, if you already have worked with groups, you probably know what groups is about. But for those who don't, if you look at groups, you can see it as a single endpoint in Office 365, which basically means that even though there are different blocks in it, you have one endpoint that you can access. So if you look at a group from an end user perspective, I can go to the group, and as a user, I can see mails. I have a shared mailbox, but I also have a place where I can store its files. It's in OneDrive. I've got something that I can use as a shared notebook. It's OneNote. You got Calendar, Skype. There is a part from CRM. You got Delve. You got Jammer. They announced Planner, which is in preview. They announced Power BI, which is coming to groups. So it's a single endpoint, even though it uses the different services that Office 365 actually uses. And if you look at it from a technical perspective, if you look at how it is built, there's actually one identity, and that identity lives in Azure Active Directory. So Azure Active Directory is the master for a group identity. That means that without Azure Active Directory, it will not be possible to create groups. So you will need Azure Active Directory. Second, it uses Exchange Online for the conversations and the calendar. Those reside in the group mailbox. Without having Exchange Online, you cannot create groups, period. It uses that, so you need it. And you can see those as sort of federated resources. So different Office 365 services can extend a group with their data. And that's what you see. You've got the Exchange, but you also got SharePoint Online, which uses the OneDrive, and it's stored, is used to store documents, and it's stored OneNote. You also have your local directory, and that's where you can create your own additional workloads and extend group functionality. Currently, that scenario is not possible yet, but it announced it at the Ignite, and it allows you to extend the group at your own services and connect to it. What it also announced at Ignite is pretty interesting if you look at it from a team site perspective. Who of you know team sites? SharePoint. Almost everyone. That's a good thing. So the first question I actually got when I did my first presentation on groups was, okay, we've got groups and we've got team site. When to use what and why should you use a group versus why should you use a team site? And it's pretty straightforward, or at least it is rather easy to answer. If you look at a team site, it was more structured. You had more options to control. You got stuff like content types. You got stuff like data loss prevention. All checks in place from an enterprise perspective to work with groups or with team sites. If you look at groups, they're more loosely. By default, everyone can create groups. Everyone can join groups as long as they're public. So you had less control around what you could and couldn't do with groups. Now, what they announced at Ignite is that from some point in time, it's currently not yet even in preview, but it is coming, you can get the option to attach a team site to a group, meaning that all the functionality that you now have in place in your team sites in SharePoint, content types, site columns, data loss prevention, can be present in a group as well. Existing groups that currently only have this out-of-the-box team site with one shared document library will eventually grow in full functional team sites, allowing you to create custom lists as well, which is rather awesome because you can then create your own task list or whatever your group needs. The idea behind is that users then can create groups from both Outlook and SharePoint, so they can go to SharePoint as well, where now in SharePoint you can only create a team site or a publishing site. It will be possible to create groups as well. And finally, as a SharePoint administrator, you obviously can still create specific team sites or site collections that are not linked to a group. Because if you're linked to a group, you get a functionality that a group offers, like the shared mailbox and the shared calendar. That's slightly different than it was used before, where, well, if you look at SharePoint, SharePoint as a team site provider, users usually couldn't create their own team sites or only could do that on specific places. If you look at the options that it allows us, besides having the option to connect team sites, you also get the option to use patterns and practices that allows us to provision stuff to actually provision team sites, connect them to groups, and have specific metadata or specific configuration in the team site that you connect to your group. That allows you to have different types of groups. So imagine that you would have a group for a team or a group for a project. You can then provision stuff in that group site and make sure that a group for a project always looks consistency or has specific, let's say, document types attached to it. A few remarks before we're gonna dive into all the cool stuff. First of all, a single user can only create 250 groups, period. You cannot create more. You can work by this by creating a new user or making someone else an administrator of that group and delete the old administrator. If you do not do that, there can be a point in time where you, as an administrator, might have created more than 215 groups and you get that error saying, you're not allowed to create any more groups, period. I've seen that in quite a few technical demos so far that I've been creating groups and then all of a sudden it was like, yeah, you can't create any groups. I'm like, okay, actually I created more, so then it will start failing. Another interesting one is if you look from a technical perspective, what we usually see is that you want to add specific administrators to a group. Out of the box, the one that creates the group becomes the administrator, but from a IT perspective, you probably want the IT department connected to it as well, stuff like that. Currently, you cannot attach groups, Active Directory groups, so you can only attach users as an administrator to the group. However, what you could do is, as soon as the team site is linked, you can still use the SharePoint permission model and add a site collection administrator to that team site. The thing is, he can then only administrator the SharePoint part of it. He cannot administer the group itself. There is no hard limit on the amount of members in a group. I've seen groups with more than 1,000 members, but according to TechNet, it would be wise to stop adding members after 1,000 because performance will be, well, not that bad. I've seen it working, but still keep in mind that if you have more than 1,000 members, consider what the options are and whether you actually need 1,000 members working on that same project. So a project is not per se a, let's say, publishing site where you're going to publish your news, obviously. Another one is, that is what's, well, it's been bugging me for quite a while. You've got Planner and you've got groups. The thing behind Planner is that you can add buckets. Has anyone seen Planner? A few. Okay, I can show it in a minute. The thing is, in order to use Planner, you'll need a group. If you create a group, it doesn't necessarily create a plan in Planner, so you will have to go to your plan yourself and make sure that to click the group, and that's actually what initializes the group to become a plan available group. So this is, from a UI perspective, rather weird. So let's do a quick demo. If I can, here I created a Tech Days group, and as you can see, it's all working. The thing is, I can click on Planner, and what's happening now is in the background, even though I haven't initiated planner before, I'm doing it now, and that means that from now on, that plan or that group actually becomes a plan as well. And the cool stuff about this is that I can create tasks lists, I can create tasks, and for those who are not aware of it, it kind of looks like Trello. So if you know work with Trello, it's pretty much the same. There's one major downside that I'm not still used to, and that's the fact that if you assign a task to someone, he or she gets an email, and if you are a member of a group, you automatically get an email from the group. So I ended up with 100 emails saying you have a new task assigned, or another task, or you finished a task, and I was like, I know, I don't want emails for it, but you can turn that off yet. I know they're working on it. Creating a group is pretty much like you would expect. You can click create, and what you get is, let me zoom in, you get the option to provide a name, description, you can set the privacy, you can even set a language, you can subscribe, and what happens is that it will automatically generate an email as well. And what you see here is if I create a group with the name test, I can see that test@digiwise is not available. Interesting part of this is that if you look at that, you will see that it generates an email. Imagine that I would create a group called, I don't know, board, director, HR. That means that it will start generating group mailboxes with that email. So if you are deploying groups in your organization, you might want to consider changing the email addresses that are handed out by groups, because if I would create HR, it will say, yeah, HR@digiwise is available, meaning that from now on, I can monitor all the emails that are coming into HR@digiwise. So it will check your exchange if it is available, but if you haven't done anything, it will automatically create that mailbox. Luckily, there are administration policies that you can apply so that naming conventions should be used, that it always get a prefix, or that a different domain should be used so that it is clear. I've seen customers create a domain called groups.customername so that you always can identify that it's not the real HR email address that you're monitoring. Luckily, from within a group, you cannot send emails, so it's not like someone can actually go to the group and send an email using that email address. But yeah, being able to see all those emails might be a bit harsh. Once you create a group, what you will see is that, let's create HR, that it starts creating. And the funny thing about it is that if I click on save, it starts preparing that group. It takes a minute to set up, but you get pretty much instantly get your group available. However, if I would now go to my files, you will see that it is either very fast today and it's finished already, but usually, ooh, it is really fast. Usually you get this notification saying your OneDrive is still being set up. So the first thing that it does is when it's creating a new group, it will first set up that conversation, that email box, and then will start up your files, your notebook, and the planner stuff. Where the planner stuff is currently not happening, the files is actually happening, but it takes a few more minutes. So it could be that you click on your files and you get a warning stating the group is not yet available. It's good to know, because I've seen scenarios where it took up to 30 minutes and I was like, hey, why are my files not there yet? Now, if you look at, start all the way anew. Let's go to this one. This is the next slide. Now, if you look at what the options are from an administrative point of view, you can obviously go to your Office 365 administration view. You can go to administer groups, and you've got specific settings that you can do. You can go to your SharePoint settings and apply DLP policies. You can go to the Office 365 Trust Center where you can apply DLP policies. So there are some things that are available through the UI. What I did is in the next few slides, I had some PowerShell queries or commands that I've seen become handy if you're working with groups and that are not necessarily possible through the UI currently. Now, if you're working with groups, the first thing that you will need to do is you'll need to make sure that you got a connection to the Exchange commandlets. So without the Exchange commandlets, you cannot connect to your groups, period. If you connect to your Exchange commandlets, you get the commandlets that are out of the box available, stuff like get unified group, set unified group, new, remove. The remove can be interesting because that's what you use to remove groups. You can do stuff with the unified group links, pretty much self-explanatory. What you can do with PowerShell but cannot do through the UI is setting something like a miltip. Having a miltip available means that if a user tries to mill that specific group, he will see that miltip. Can be interesting. What you cannot do through the UI is change the email address. So once a group is created, the email address is fixed. Unless you use PowerShell, then you can set the primary SMTP address. What's also interesting is the classification part. Classification is something Microsoft uses to currently flag a group whether it has high impact, low impact, or medium impact. What's interesting about this flag is that MSDN states it's an internal use property only, and if you look at the PowerShell commandlets and the documentation there, they encourage you to actually set that property to identify whether a group contains specific information or not. You can also change the access type from public to private. That's not something you can do through the UI, only on creation, but you cannot change it afterwards. And through PowerShell, you can flick that to say, hey, this was a public group, now it is private. What's also interesting is that since it's all in Exchange, you could do stuff with the mailbox statistics. So, as I said, it contains a mailbox, and what we could do is we could then retrieve all the unified groups, retrieve the mailbox statistics for that specific group, and then use the last logon time and say, I want all mailboxes that have a last logon time greater than the last 7 days. Meaning that I get an overview of all groups where someone accessed that mailbox. So someone actually went to that specific mailbox, opened it in the UI or in their client, and actually did something. That's probably pretty interesting in identifying whether a group has been used. You can use this to actually remove or archive groups that are no longer active. The thing is, it's not only emails in a group. There's also something called a team site. And currently it's still a out-of-the-box team site. Future reference might be something more advanced. The lucky thing is that it says set SPO site. That definitely should be a get SPO. It should be set. What you could do, wrong demo, you could apply policies like storage quota to a team site. So, you could do set SPO site. The thing is, for set SPO site, you would actually need to also load the SharePoint Online commandlets. So, they're not in the Exchange Online commandlets, but you can combine them. Because from the group, we get the SharePoint Documents URL. And the SharePoint Documents URL is a full URL to the shared documents folder that is linked to the group. For us, it would be not the document library URL, it would be the team site URL, and you can apply a storage quota to that specific site, allowing you to change your group storage quota. What you also could do is you could retrieve the last content modify date. So I could retrieve that group, retrieve the site, and then see when was the last time something has been changed in that specific team site. So with that previous sample, where we got the last logon time, you could combine those two to get both the last logon time of the mailbox and the last content modification date, and use that to actually remove a group if it's no longer used or hasn't been used in the last, let's say, 7 months or 8 months, whatever. What you can also do is that out of the box, those groups are available to everyone. Meaning everyone within your organization can create groups. Meaning everyone can create that HR group. If you are in a production scenario and you're considering rolling out groups, you might want to start using groups with a small set of users. Maybe only administrators can play around with it, see what's been possible. And the thing with that is, in order to create groups, you need exchange, and you can apply mailbox policies. So what you could do is you can get the out-of-the-box template that I provided for us that allows you to apply settings, which is the MSO template settings with a template ID that I don't know by heart yet. You can create a new setting object, and then you can say you cannot create groups, so enable group creation false. You can then say you can even apply a GUID of the group that you want to allow user want to create groups. This is the group creation allowed group ID. You can apply a URL, you can add a classification list, change something in there, and then just apply those settings. What you also could do is you could, with a mailbox policy, select a single user and apply that mailbox policy to a single user. So you could create two mailbox policies. One where you say no one can create them, apply them to everyone, and then create a new mailbox policy where you allow them to create and apply that policy only to one or two users, making sure that no one else in your organization can create groups. That's from an administrative standpoint. Now, if you look at extensibility developers, there are actually two options. The first one is you probably want to work with content in a group, and you want to change stuff in the content, or you want to modify stuff there. Now, the first one is connectors. So what I did is, when groups came out, they came up with the idea of webhooks. Who knows webhooks? No one? Ooh, too bad. I'll do a little bit of explaining there. What they actually did is they used webhooks to create something called connectors. And the idea behind this is that you can create or connect an application with your group. And it's probably easier to just show you. What I can do is I can click this button on the top called connectors. And with connectors, you get the option to, as it says, keep current content and updates of interest from other services in your group. And here you can see you can add different connectors, different applications. Now, those applications, what they will do is they will add content, add a mail to your group on a specific trigger. So if I would do Twitter, it's probably the easiest one, I can say, what do you want? Do you want to track a hashtag, or do you want to follow specific accounts? Do you want to include retweets or mentions? Do you want a daily digest, or do you want every 50 minutes a digest? Whatever you want. And if I would fill this in, I will get an email in my group every time something happens on Twitter. So if I go to my Tech Days, let me click this, Tech Days group, what you see here is that I created one for the Tech Days NL hashtag, and now every 30 minutes I get an update with all the Twitter or tweets that actually been tweeted with that hashtag, and they come in my group. As you have seen, there are quite a lot of different services available. Trello, RSS, Wunderlist, you name them. There is a list of over 60 of those services that allows you to connect to their server and, based on a trigger, do something. So if you're using some different system, what you can do is you can hook it up, link it to a group, and get an email notification in that group. Now, what I've seen is that in backend systems, when an opportunity got closed, an announcement went to the client group stating, hey, this opportunity has been closed. Or if something has been approved, hey, this has been approved. Now, with this set of services, it's around 60. There are quite a few. But what if you've got your own backend system? Luckily for us, they came up with this really cool stuff called the Connector Sandbox. And the Connector Sandbox actually allows you to play around with it. And if you don't have any experience with webhooks, you should definitely read a little bit up on it. But it's fairly easy. What actually happens is that you will need to do a post to a specific webhook URL. And if you create a new webhook, you have to register this. in the Connect Playground, it actually does that for you. So what I did is I went here, clicked on Connect to Office 365. It will log in. It will ask you, are you sure? What group can you post to? There's this little security model. But once you logged in, you actually get that option. And here you see that all I need to do is have a little bit of JSON and post it to a URL. So if I would then, let's see, grab this one, connectors, there we go. I would paste it in. It's just JSON. It says it's a little bit of text. It's a title. I can see some actions, and you can make this far more advanced than you like. I can do a preview, see what actually will be posted. Here I can see it's an Allison demo, and I can say post message. Then it will take a second to actually do something. If you would fire up Fiddler and see what is going over the wire, you will actually see that it just does a post to the URL that is provided as the webhook URL. And if I would now go to my group mail, click away, I can see new activity, and there we go, make sure to present. So webhooks and connectors allow you to connect your data and or backend system and push in data into your Office 365 group. It only allows you to push emails. So it's not about pushing content like files or meetings or whatever. It is only about adding new conversations in a group. Let's press the right one now. Then the next one is, what if you want to do more advanced stuff? So what if you are considering working with every entity that you would have in a group? Then there is a last option that's working with the Microsoft Graph. How many of you have heard of the Microsoft Graph? Okay, a few. For those who haven't heard of it, it's a single endpoint that allows you to talk to the different Office 365 services and access or modify data over different services. As I've said, Groups is like an entity but contains different services of Office 365. So if you want to talk to different services, you have to use the graph as a endpoint. So what we did is I made a quick demo, and in the demo I created a single page application in Angular. Now if you're a developer, you probably heard of Angular, so I'm not going to dive too much into that part, but what it does is it retrieves all the groups. And what I can then do is I can say, let me refresh it, make sure that it's created. And here you can see that the HR group that I just created is actually there. That's awesome. What I can show you, well, let's go a little bit, because I also created the planner overview. Here you can see that I got less groups. So if I go to my groups, I've got 5 results. If I go to planner, I've got less results. And what's missing is that HR group. So even though I created that HR group, apparently I haven't gone to Planner and connected to it, so it's not connected to my account yet, and it will not show up in my Planner overview. A little bit on that later. If I go to my Groups overview, what you will see is that it retrieves the group, it retrieves the name, and it retrieves the image. Now, how did we do that? What we actually did is we went to the graph, we did a REST query, and we retrieved all groups. In order to do that, the first thing you need to do is you need to register an application. And registering applications, assign access to it through the Azure portal. Otherwise, I cannot access my group resources. So let's go to too bad it's not open. Let's see if I can find my Active Directory. Or not. Nah, I'm gonna skip that part. What you get then is you get an application ID, and that application ID has been used to actually request all the data. So if I go to my home controller, let's go all the way up, you can see that what I do is I load user data, and from that load user data I actually get my groups. And then for each group I'm going to process that. So if I go to my groups, let's see, I've got my get my groups. What I do here is I just do a REST query, a get, and I get the top 500 groups for me as a user. That means that everyone who does this actually retrieves their 500 groups, which is rather interesting. All I need to do for this is create an Angular application, make sure that my permissions are set, make sure that everything is in order, and I can actually retrieve all those groups. Now what I also can do is I can create a new group. So if I would go to symbol 2, I can create a new group. There you go. It takes a minute to wire up, and then finally it gets created. What actually happens on the background is if I go back to my home controller, you will see that I do a create group. Let's see. In that create group, I'm gonna flag that a new group is creating so that I cannot create any more groups while it is creating. And then I go to my data service. And if you look at the data service, creating a group is just as easy as doing, well, anything else. All I need to do is I have to need to have a JSON object for a specific group. And what I did here is I created one with a display name. I made sure that the group type was a unified group. And I can go to mail enabled, security enabled. I can change that. You can pretty much every property that you could either set to PowerShell or that you could either set through whatever, you can walk through it. The thing is, I need to set an owner. Or, well, actually it's not required, but it's pretty, it would be smart to do so. Because if you do not set an owner, what actually happens, it will create a group and it will add me as an owner by default, but it will not add me as a member. So what happens is that I'm not seeing that specific group. If I add myself as owner, it will automatically add me as a member as well. So that will speed a bit of the amount of calls that you need to do. What also interesting is if you look at the way the graph is working, you'll get an object that contains your group. And what you see here is I also have a call called group details. So what I do is I get my group, and then for each group, I'll actually, let's see, also could say I'm gonna need group details. So saying group details, what you could do in the group details, you need stuff like a group picture, group files URL. And out of the box, what you get back as a group object does not contain a picture yet. So if I would go back here and I would press F5, you'll see that the pictures are actually coming in later. That is because the picture files needs to be retrieved separate. So if you're working with groups, you need to be aware that if you're working with the graph in combination with groups, there are some dependencies that are not coming in directly in your request. So you need to make sure that you retrieve them as well. Now if I go back to my planner overview, then you will see that it is slightly different. Get group details, get plans. You will see that I can do a /me/plans. So I can either get my groups and I can get my plans. And this is where you have to be aware that groups and plans, even though they are communicated as being the same, so you get a plan for every group, from a endpoint and development perspective, there are still two different containers. You'll need a group to create a plan, but creating a group is not enough. And if you want to work with your plans, and if you want to create stuff in your plans, then you still need to make sure that you retrieve them correctly. So, what if you want to do the next steps? What are the first things you need to do before moving on? Well, there are some useful links. You can go to dev.office.com/getting-started. That allows you to find resources just for plain Office 365 development. If you want to work with connectors, you should definitely check out dev.outlook.com/connectors, because that contains that part where you get that sandbox, where you can actually try and play around with those specific cards without actually having to build all the plumbing yourself. Once you've got your card likes you need them, you can start building your first app. And if you want to work with the graph, you should definitely check out graph.microsoft.io, because that contains a sandbox as well, where you can easily play around with different URLs. Definitely start coding and provide feedback on office-spdev.uservoice. With that, we've got a few minutes left for questions. Anyone? In the back. So the question is it possible to lock OneDrive and use DeepSize? Oh, TeamSize. Okay. So is it possible to lock OneDrive and only use TeamSize? So TeamSize is coming, and they haven't announced yet whether you can manipulate that process. However, what they announced is actually two things. First of all existing groups will be upgraded to have a TeamSize. So if you look from it from a SharePoint perspective, actually there's already a site collection for each group, so upgrading that should be fairly easy. Second, all new groups will automatically have a team site, period. So you can either block everyone from creating groups as a whole, or everyone can create groups, but then they will also have a team site connected to it. Other questions? Looks like it's... One more?
What about licensing
In groups? So the question is, how does licensing work in groups? If you look at it from a licensing perspective, you only need a Azure Active Directory license. So if you have a Office 365 E1, I assume, that would be enough to use both the SharePoint part of it and the Exchange part of it. A user that creates a group should have a license. After that, there's no need for you to have Exchange calls or SharePoint calls to actually access that group. Even though, if you would look at the technical bits, it is kind of like a shared mailbox. So, or actually, it's a combination between a shared mailbox and a distribution list. But there's no licensing fee for using a specific group. You get them for free. I think that's it. Time for lunch.